Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Activate Yourself with Gita Sidhu-Rob, where we feature otherwise normal people who, because of events in their life, have turned left and done unusual, inspiring, incredible things, like build a business, become a happiness expert, marry a prince, create an empire, or like your host, set up a health and wellness business, Nosh Detox. Here's your host, Gita Sidhu-Rob.
Hi, my name is Gita Sidhu-Rob, and this is Activate Yourself. So we're always having guests on that changed their lives because something happens to them. Today's guest is somebody who wants to change your life. And I think that that's actually a really good segue, because getting to the place where we live in a world where every day feels like it's almost a year because yet another crisis comes. In fact, I feel like we're on crisis overload. So you're like, yeah, I should just eat ice cream, because honestly, I can't quite handle yet another crisis happening. Particularly while I wait for ground troops to invade Iran, that's slightly worrying my brain. And today's guest, Dex Hunter-Torres, is somebody that I saw on stage a few months ago, and I thought, I love this man, I'm keeping him forever, and I've really not quite let him escape since then. So it sucks to be you, Dex, but I'm still going to keep you. And Dex is a leading thinker on AI and society, has decided to use that as a force for good. Dex, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Why did you decide to wake up and change the world?
It's weird. I never really understood how anybody who's got the opportunity to change the world could not want to do that. And like, that's probably like, you know, coming from a place where, you know, I'd spent my whole life, you know, thinking about how to have that kind of impact. For me, you know, I grew up in a time and a place where life was very, very hard. I grew up in the 80s and the 90s in the UK. My dad was a refugee from Burma during the Second World War, and he was a child refugee and had come to the UK in the 50s. My mother was a immigrant from Malaysia who'd come to the UK in the 70s to work in the NHS as a nurse. And things were really, really hard growing up. Often I meet people now and they just assume after you've sort of worked with a whole bunch of, you know, leaders from, you know, tech and politics and so on, that you must just inhabit a world that is very unrepresentative and privileged. And that world has been your reality for your whole life. And that's not true at all. I was always driven by, I would say, like an anger about the way the world was organized. I was angry as a kid why life was so hard and why some people seem to have, you know, lives they were born into where the path towards success was much, much easier. And for most other people, things, you know, felt like the system was genuinely stacked against you. And so throughout my life, I always wanted to go and work on trying to fix those systems. And that's what took me into a career where for 17 years, I was working with a bunch of tech leaders and political leaders, trying to advance these big, you know, solutions and institutions and technologies that could really lift up, you know, a lot of people's lives, you know, in a big visible way. But over time, I realized just how defunct and dysfunctional a bunch of those systems are. And I've spent the, you know, last, you know, chapter of my career at the center of AI and technology. And I now look at the future with a great deal of dread. I think the path we're on as societies is likely to lead to devastating consequences for the majority of people in the world. And that includes in the most advanced economies, like in the UK. And we really need a different set of solutions now to navigate a future which is being shaped enormously by technology. So end of September, I finished my career in big tech. And in February 2026, I launched this new nonprofit, the Center for Tomorrow, which is focused on trying to find those solutions. So in a way, it's a new chapter for me, but at the same time, it's really, you know, continuing this quest, which I think has driven my whole life, honestly, since I was a kid.
I actually do. I'm listening to you and it's making me smile because firstly, I think we should talk about some of the people you've worked for so people understand literally what you mean. But before we do that, I said this yesterday. I was being interviewed by someone and I said, I think I've done a lot of the things I've done because people annoyed me so much that I insisted on doing them. You sound a little bit like that's exactly what's driven you as well, because it's like, this is unbelievable. How is no one doing something about this?
Yeah, I mean, and this is, I mean, genuinely, I think this is why a lot of people are angry now. Like, there's a tremendous mood of, unrest, I think, running through most societies, because so many of the powerful folks who have the ability to shape our lives, they've chosen either to stay silent or do nothing, or they're actually actively, you know, fanning the flames of many of the disasters, and the consequences always fall on ordinary people, the hardest and on the most vulnerable populations in the world. And people, they're sick and tired of this now. All our chickens are coming home to roost, all the decades of not dealing with our problems. And so now I just fundamentally think either we confront those problems head on and we come up with, you know, real, probably quite radical solutions to break that logjam in our systems on how to navigate them, or fundamentally, you know, we're going to end up with a very, very fast, uncontrollable, unpredictable process of transition in those systems. Guaranteed the elites won't like that one bit either.
Well, one hopes, right? Because what's actually happening is that if you look at what happens at the moment in terms of the war, you see people making money off pronouncements that they knew were going to come out. And mm-hmm. we don't even hate it anymore, right? This has always been to me the absolute sole benefit of Trump, that there is nothing that he hides. And we learn things that we just didn't know unless Trump comes into a power and goes, I don't give a shit about any of you. Let me just talk about the things that matter to me. And you think, I grew up in a very wealthy family, unlike you. And my father used to always say, actually, you need to work out when you have enough. Mm-hmm. Because once you have enough, then you understand you have enough, you change how you live your life, which is why I've always been impact driven, because that's what I was told was my responsibility as somebody to whom much was given, right? And so it just, and then of course the divorce left me completely poverty stricken. So it's been good to get both sides. I infinitely prefer being rich. Just point that out for the peanut gallery, but it wasn't fun. So it's really interesting to me. Let me just quickly go through, because your key roles in advising leaders have been Elon Musk at SpaceX, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, Eric Schmidt at Google, and the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. And then you also led global comms and marketing with Google DeepMind. And you came, so it's not like you've come out of, you know, middle management going, oh, I must find something to do with my life. You came out of what is literally the top of the top and gone, holy shit, if this keeps going on, we're in deep trouble, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I started my career, you know, very simplistic, I kind of thought, can I get into the room where enough people are trying to change the world, and then find whatever contribution, you know, I could deliver. You know, I would focus on, you know, whatever I could do. And I've been in a lot of rooms now where you have people with tremendous influence who are shaping our reality and the reality of millions or billions of people. And I think one of the most staggering unmooring experiences of my life has been discovering that in all those rooms, there's almost no plan on how to actually manage most of our biggest problems in any way that is going to fundamentally solve them. You can have lots of individually useful efforts, which are sort of tiny, you know, pinprick solutions. You can have lots of other things which are entirely performative and don't solve anything. And you can have things which really aggravate the problem, but really discovering that there's almost no like real plan, no coordinated efforts, the thinking is extraordinarily dysfunctional and siloed about things that are massive and will be devastating if they're, you know, managed in that way. That really staggered me. And you know, that's the thing, you know, I think a lot of people get through life assuming there's some other room of people solving problems. And like quite serious decision makers often put faith in those systems because they assume other parts of the system are being, you know, managed, you know, to deal with these problems. And that's just not the case. There is no secret other room of people who will solve our problems. We either step up and we come up with new ways to manage them, or we're basically going to try and wing it through the arrival of the most powerful technology in history and the decay of all of our systems now.
Do you not think that they think that because it's a really useful tool to hide behind to say, well, therefore I'm allowed to focus on what I want?
Some of them. I mean, I think a lot of other people, you know, I think a lot of people just try to get through the day and they don't really think about it at all, which is one of, you know, again, it's one of the most, you know, alarming things, because certainly, you know, I feel I've been relatively intentional throughout my life about the things I spend time on. And there's a lot of people who are so seduced by the short term, often sort of more glitzy bits of what it means to be a leader. You know, Davos is the perfect example, right? It is the ultimate sort of spectacle. Every, you know, January, you get huge chunks of the world's leaders who decamp, you know, to a mountainside in Switzerland to talk about the biggest problems in the world. And very little of substance comes out of Davos. It is a thing which I think 99% of people who go to Davos, they do it basically for Instagram. And it's like, that is like unbelievable to me. Like, you know, why are you doing this to be performative when there's like real issues that, and real impact you could be having? It's just, it's a sort of elite norm that's been conditioned. And so now it's like a big deal for people to be invited to these sort of confabs. And yeah, you know, I've been to any number of these sorts of things, and I just fundamentally never cared about the spectacle of the thing.
We had actually, so we're going to go for a quick break and we'll come back. And I want to actually tell you about my experience in Davos this year.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So we're back, and I host an event in Davos this year, obviously on Davos, where I wanted to create an event for the last 6 months before Davos called Reimagining the World for Women. And I wanted that to be part of the Davos lineup. And I struggled so much to get a women's agenda onto anything to do with Davos. And at the very, very last minute, I got a massive American company who was that had a woman that ran a foundation who said, oh, yeah, why don't we do that? Because Davos is on it, you know, it's like $30,000 to hire a room for an hour. And that's just the beginning before you go anywhere else. So to actually do something like that for women that are traditionally underfunded is a really, really hard thing. And so I found that a really interesting experience because they kept trying to take the name of it down off the list of events. And I was like, oh, no, I don't think so. And I waited until the day before, went back up. I changed the name to what they wanted and changed it back to the name I wanted the day before when it was too late to kind of change it. And I was like, no, we'll just keep that. And so I want to do that again next year because I'm like, how much more can we continue to do this to force you to listen to what it is that we're creating and become part of your world instead of you ignoring us every step of the way, right? But it is, Davos is very much like that. And I find it very interesting, the response I got from having hosted my event at Davos in reality. So when you look at this room, these rooms that you've been part of, and you see the way the technology is changing, is this the right question to ask you? What are the fears that actually first come to mind for you?
I mean, for me, I think because I've always been really focused on these questions about how do you make systems serve the interests of the world, ordinary people, the majority of whom live lives that are very hard. I look at the future shaped by technology and the intersection of that technology with, you know, all the vast crises we now already face economically, politically, geopolitically, environmentally. And I see the quality of life for people being vastly diminished in a relatively short window of time. That's right. Because we fail to think through just how these technologies will ripple out across our societies. Perfect example, we already have a world right now where 12 billionaires have as much wealth as 49% of humanity. And that's before we've ended up in a future where access to increasingly advanced AI will continue to concentrate resources in a smaller and smaller portion of the population. Because guess what? AI allows you to do vastly more with less people. And this is something as well, which, you know, there's a tremendous, wish fulfillment, and sort of fantasizing going on amongst a bunch of leaders who sort of cling to the idea that AI will just ultimately give everybody, a job and give them, you know, a slice of the opportunities, perhaps even greater than what they've got today, without fundamentally reforming these systems. I don't think that's true at all. The future of every company and organization is likely to be much, much leaner over the next decade. You will be able to have companies, you know, where right now you have hundreds of people, where you will instead have dozens. And the dozens who will be overseeing the work of huge numbers of AI systems, they will be many of the best performers. They'll be the people who are most sophisticated, the winners of the AI era. That's great. Except those folks often already, you know, come from backgrounds where they've had, you know, enormous, you know, resources and privilege and so on. What will happen to the vast numbers of other workers who don't have a place in those companies anymore? We often have this very simplistic, you know, debate, you know, when you start talking about these things, where people say, yes, there will be new jobs created. It's a bunch of doomsday stuff, you know, to say we won't look at the Industrial Revolution. Lots of new jobs were created. Yes, there will still be jobs, of course, but the point isn't about whether there will be some human jobs in the future. It's, are there enough, and what type of them, what quality are those jobs to go around, and how do those resources get concentrated in different parts of our societies? And so if we're already in a world right now where inequality is such a staggering issue, where you've got advanced economies that have plateaued in growth, you've had declining living standards and stagnating wages, and that has fueled a whole bunch of political, you know, and geopolitical outcomes, just imagine what's going to happen on the current path, where you do have even slight, you know, disruptions in that economic model, and it gets much worse.
Okay, hang on. Let me just like make that real for you. Both my daughter and my stepdaughter, who are in their early 20s, their entire years from university don't have work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Their entire years, Dex, do not have. They have spreadsheets where they send out CVs. Spreadsheets,
yep,
where they monitor and track, and they do not have work. I don't think they will ever find work without a basic level of nepotism. And the problem with that is that it leads itself to the privileged few always continuing to have access, which it really annoys the crap out of me, frankly, because it perpetuates the system that we've already got in place. How can you have entire years of university with immense university debt, which we are fueling that debt because we're trying to kill everybody much in the way America has done with this enormous amount of debt, and yet you can't actually work in any way for that? That's insane. I have a child who isn't even 25, who has debt of £50,000 from university.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And this is the kind of thing where, having access to connections and resources, now is going to dramatically impact, you know, your success. And most people don't have those resources.
No, they don't.
A lot of, you know, people who, you know, start from positions of, you know, wealth and influence, they just sort of assume everyone has access to these things. And I don't think that's true at all. You know, over 50% of the UK population lives paycheck to paycheck. And this is in, what, the sixth largest economy in the world. You know, in the US, more than 60% of the population lives paycheck to paycheck. So, like, the idea that people have the security to indulge in even some of the sloganeering solutions to this moment, right? Upskilling. Everywhere you go, there's this mythical invocation that as AI transforms jobs and skills, we should upskill everyone. Well, tell me how you're supposed to spend the time or have the resources to go and do that, if you even knew where to get that support.
I was going to say,
right.
I work all the time with women. I talk about what it is that women need and what women are trying to achieve and how we change the status quo for women. And the conversation that always comes to my mind when I'm listening to you is, yes, and it's a problem. And then below that, women have another problem entirely. Because when anything bad happens, it happens more to women because they're poorer, because they have less choices, They're usually, not always, but they tend to have less education, and they actually don't have the ability to make more money. There are statistics that show that when women join a particular work stream, the amount of money paid in that work stream drops by 20% within 18 months. So everything you're saying, can we just add that and multiply it? Because it's going to happen to women worse. And women are the people that take care of children the most. So we're saying, we're condemning stratas of society, because no one talks about how this impacts women, right? Because we're already being screwed. And then this is worse. Let me not even start women of color, because then you become an even smaller minority within that, right?
Many of the knowledge economy jobs that evolved over the last several decades, that became critical engines of advancement in societies for women and underrepresented communities, those are the jobs that are now most vulnerable in the first waves of the automation that's taking place in the AI era. And so, like, that's a fundamental fact, which, I mean, it's astonishing to me the number of leaders who simply ignore those consequences. Just as the earlier wave of automation in the sort of, 70s, 80s, that displaced a lot of manufacturing jobs, which were often very male-dominated industries. That had a huge impact on men, and it led to huge, cultural shifts in society, all sorts of consequences that, still are barely understood. But now there's another wave of automation that is going to hit women and underrepresented communities really, really hard. And so this is exactly what I'm talking about. The consequences of chaotic disruption in our societies unmanaged, they will land upon people who face the hardest consequences and always have. And this is just unacceptable to me that we don't have a serious plan for how to deal with that.
And also that there's no padding for the recovery. This is the thing. There aren't the same, we're the childhood poverty capital of Europe. So there's no padding for us anywhere to fall back on. We're screwed. We're going to go on that bright note. We're going to go for a break and we'll come straight back. And I want to talk about, when we come back for our last segment, I want to talk about your solutions and what you think you can do and we can do for that.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So we're back. What do you think we can do?
There are so many things we can do. This is the thing, right? These are massive crises. These are things that, you can just spend, every day looking at the chaos and think I'm powerless. And that's not true. There are obviously the systemic solutions that we need to have. And if you are a leader with any capacity to influence any of those things, then that is what you should be searching for now. Not the performative things, not the, I'm going to have a nice, event, just because I want to say I, had a nice event. Really being honest with yourself and having a theory of change that actually is driving towards those big systemic fixes. And the things that, I focus on in particular are, how do you transform our economic systems so that you actually deal with that future where AI will have displacing effects on jobs, will lead to radically different economic outcomes? How do you build a different international order so that the biggest military rearmament in history and our eroding international system does not fuel a final world war in the age of intelligence, which will be supercharged by intelligence? And how do you deal with the effects on our climate? How do you preserve our natural world when we know that we're heading for some of the worst case consequences of climate change? All of those are big systemic things. Lots of leaders work for organizations in roles for causes that do address bits of it. Many of those solutions end up very siloed and don't have a thesis of change grounded in what is really happening across our societies. So that's the first thing. More practically, right? Because lots of people aren't working on those things. You may be, you could be doing any job. You could be, simply a citizen, and you think, what can I do? Well, the minimal thing we can do, right, is pay attention to what's happening so that we then can form our own thesis on what to do about these things, right? I can give sort of, advice that works for a lot of people, but like, you ultimately are the guardian of your own life. You know roughly what you want to do in your life, hopefully. If not, that's a bigger question, which we can spend a much time talking about. But certainly, this is a thing where I meet so many serious leaders who do have access to the whole world's information at their fingertips, they're in jobs and roles where they should actually be paying attention, and they sort of don't take it seriously. So like the minimum thing, right, is to understand what do you think is happening technologically? What do you think is going to happen to jobs? What do you think is going to be the terrain in which your family and your kids and your own life will be existing in just the next few years? Otherwise, you're winging it. But then there is another much larger bucket of things where you can really spend time on. Have you done the work to transform yourself for this future? Just personally. Yeah. You know, there's paying attention and there's like working on the problem at the macro level if you actually have a role. But like at the micro level, have you invested in your own skills for a world and a world of work that is changing? Have you thought through, you know, how you want to impact these things or survive these things, you know, over the coming years? Have you thought through about how you're going to support your community, your friends, your family? There's so many instruments of change. And in a way, it starts really with thinking, do I have my own personal disruption strategy? We can talk about disruption at the most macro level, at the organizational, the civilizational level. But it's weird to me when you meet people who just don't have any individual plan for themselves. And so that's the thing where, you know, I would start by saying, pay attention, understand what's going on. You don't have to believe anything anyone, including me, is saying about the future, but you've got to have your own thesis. And then do you have a plan of what you're going to do over the next, you know, 6, 12 months, over the next 5 years? Because like, you probably want to have a good life and a long life, and you probably want to be successful 10 years from now. Have you invested in all the things to get you to success 10 years from now?
Personally, yes. But then that's what I do for a living. So we're good at that.
Totally. I think you're probably a rarity, Geeta.
But I mean, that's why I wanted you on the show, because you're another rarity. It's why I love what you say so much. It's why I listen to what you say and I follow it, because I really think, you know, I've never been inspired by immense amounts of money, whether I had money or I never had money. It just never did anything for me. And I'm like, if you're not getting up and trying to make the world better, trying to change the things that you can see, what the hell is the point of you, according to me? I really don't understand that. And when we were talking yesterday, I was talking to a women's group, and it's just because the conversations have come side by side. They're like, how can you have impact? And I said, I'm saying that I have learned that speaking has impact. Literally saying the things that you think of from your perspective, because they land for the people who you represent. How can you not say something when you can see that, right?
That's right. Well, I mean, I spent a lot of my career in communications because I absolutely believe communications is a critical, incredibly significant thing if you want to do anything in the world. And it is astonishing to me the number of people who think comms or talking about the problem is like some sort of worthless exercise. And it's like, that is why we're in the mess we're in. Like, we literally haven't talked enough about the real problems or the solutions. And talking is the start of every solution. That is literally how you get to things. I mean, this was, you know, always, you know, absurd to me when I worked at the UN at the start of my career, and people would say, the UN's just a talking shop. I'd be like, yeah, that's actually not a bug. That is a feature. Like, the whole point is there should be one place in the world where the whole world shows up and they're made to talk to each other, because talking is usually better than, you know, fighting each other. And like, that was a thing where it wasn't that, you know, talking didn't have value. It was that idiots didn't understand the value of talking. And so this is something now where when people say, oh, words are cheap, I'm like, well, you're not even willing to do that. You won't even do the bare minimum to speak up on these things. So let's talk about the value of these things all over again.
No, I completely agree. But I also, I'm a little more cynical in that I think that a lot of the people that aren't having the conversations is because they don't want to. Because they have the conversation is almost the opening of the door into the next step, so that it forces you to get off your ass and do something. I mean, when I was looking for some reason at how much TV people watch in an evening, and I was like, so you actually spend 6 to 7 hours in front of a TV, but your life sucks. I wonder if there's a correlation, you know, any correlation. Let's just ask someone randomly. It's insane. And I do, yeah, I try and maintain a level of optimism, but I think when I speak to you, I feel more optimistic that I think that there, you know, I do a lot around the women's side. And what I see you doing something is around the male conversation. And that makes me happy, because you need people that will have global conversations. It's much harder for women to do those things. And
absolutely.
So you, it is. It's, I mean, I do it all the time. So I know how bloody hard it is. So I always think that with what you're doing, it deserves as much support as it can have. If you can enter the rooms, I'm commonly in a room with a lot of presidents, people that run things, not so much corporations, so they have less power, And I'm always the only woman, and I'm always the only non-white woman, a person. And I'm just like,
yeah, that's wild. I mean, it's so interesting, right? That as the world has become more and more complex, and we're now dealing with the consequences of an age of complexity, you've actually had a lot of leaders and resources retreat from thinking about inclusion as a strategic, essential priority. And for me, that's just absurd because, you know, inclusion was always literally about, did you have, you know, enough brains and perspectives and points of view in the room who could then end up shaping the solutions for a deeply complex, multifaceted world, so we can actually solve the problems that ail all of us. You know, the struggles of one community in a planetary interconnected world are not one community. They're all of us. They change the nature, the character, the reality of the entire world and all of our societies. And so, you know, there's a bunch of people who just sort of like thought, oh, for short-term political expediency, I'll give up talking about some of these things because it's useful to navigate, you know, some of the more right-wing political terrain of the moment. And I just think you have shot yourself in the foot.
Completely. Oh my God. And it annoys me so much. I'm like, how can you not think that if you bomb in somewhere in Palestine and Syria and Lebanon and everywhere, and then you see immigration being made different? You're like, really? Your actions have no consequences? There's no follow. Anyway, I could start ranting, and it's not because it's all a show about you. So I'll rant more privately, but it annoys the crap out of me because I look at them and I'm like, I look at the things that happened with Keir Starmer, where he was one of the most awaited prime ministers. And he comes on and can't have blunt conversations. And I'm like, I don't need you to join in on this, but what the hell are you doing here? Why are you here if you can't have a conversation that tells Tommy Robinson to go to hell, right? There just isn't a point to you. Anyway, so I said I wouldn't rant. Thank you very much for coming on, Dex.
Well, there's a critical point here, right, which I really like to push everywhere, which is it is not pessimistic or wrong to raise the problems that ail. And like, you know, this is a classic sort of norm and behavior we, you know, indoctrinate in people, you know, particularly in, you know, industries and roles, you know, as they get more senior. If you, you know, sound too, you know, tough, or, you know, you're too critical on the nature of these problems, people sort of take you less seriously because, you know, we've been trained that you shouldn't rock the boat, you know, literally down to tone of voice. And you know, the person who runs the meeting should be very calm. And, you know, this is a bunch of behaviors that actually over time have like ended up, I think, suppressing the urgency and the tenor of the conversation we truly need to have. It is not more optimistic to pretend things are fine or to diminish the scale of disasters we face and calling them actual disasters. That is actually a deeply pessimistic, cynical view of human nature because it assumes that we're not adult or mature enough to have a conversation about our problems. Actually, the better course is just to sweep them under the rug. And that's not hopeful. That is a path to disaster. And so actually, admitting our problems is the first step to solving them. And so, you know, this is why often when I talk about, you know, the scale of these massive disasters, you know, there'll be some slice of people who tries to laugh it off or say, oh, on that cheerful note, and they'll try to change the subject. But I think the people who really do care, and you know, the people I identify with who are on my wavelength, they say, right, well, we've got that understanding now. Let's talk about how we fix it. And that's how you actually then actually go and fix it.
I agree entirely. And I think there's the other added gender lens I just want to add to that, which is that women struggle to have these conversations without being attacked, without being called strident, without being called bitchy. And it has to be a conversation that men have in the country, the world that we live in. So more men need to be able to say these things where we can actually give the viewpoint of what women need and see and have, because we live so much on the coalface. We can tell you these problems are happening because we're having these problems, right? And so I'm 1,000% behind you on that. I really agree. Where can people find you?
You can follow the work of the Center for Tomorrow, my new nonprofit, at www.centerfortomorrow.com. Find me on LinkedIn, Instagram, wherever you're using social media. But genuinely, like the last few weeks, the last few months have just been amazing because I've met so many brilliant, you know, folks working on change in so many different places, business, civil society, governments, all over the world, who I think now really understand that we need a different way of life. We need solutions that get beyond the performative. There's actually, I think, way more of us than you might, you know, expect. You know, I think often change makers can feel very, you know, ground down because of the reality of the world and the things that we spend all day looking at, the problems that we focus on. But there is actually a constituency that is there, that is waking up and that is ready to go. It's not a demand problem, it's a supply problem. And so now we really need to supply those spaces, those solutions to actually shift things.
Agreed. Thank you very much, Dex Hunter-Torek. It has been a pleasure to have you on, and I wish you the very best with everything that you're doing.
Thanks, Geeta. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Our goal was to give you pause, make you think about your life, and inspire you to say, wow, what if I tried to do that? If they can do it, so can I. Did it work? Let us know by finding us on social media at Geeta Sidhu Rob or at Nosh Detox. We upload new shows every 2 weeks here. And if you start to miss us, check us out on YouTube.